Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It is Friday. Hooray. And we've got some great guests in conversation this morning. In just a minute, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Also today, the currency of relationships. The interesting new Wall Street Journal columnist, Catherine Rossman, which is not just, her column is not just about money, but what do you barter with in general if you're married with children or otherwise involved, the currency of relationships. And Studio 360 host Kurt Anderson and creator Julie Burstein will be here for a creative listeners poll. We will play clips from their show from artists like Richard Serra, Isabel Allende, and Joyce Carol Oates and ask you questions like, is your creativity more like going to work or more like thinking and dreaming? Really hear what Joyce Carol Oates and Isabel Allende have to say about that. And is your creativity driven more by the beautiful, the terrible, or the ordinary? And we'll continue our week-long series today asking questions on the National Standardized Science Test, which our kids are just not very good at in this country. Today, some scientist questions about animals and evolution. All coming up. Paul Krugman in just a moment. Some very good job numbers came out this morning. Maybe you've been hearing nearly 200,000 new jobs were created last month, 192,000 to be exact, according to the Labor Department. And the unemployment rate dipped below 9% for the first time in about 2 years. So let's get a take on that and some other intersections of money and politics with New York Times columnist and Princeton economics professor Paul Krugman. Hi, Dr. Krugman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there.
First, what's your reaction to today's unemployment report?
Well, it's good. I mean, you always want to have some perspective here. You know, this is during the boom of the 1990s, during the Clinton years, the economy was adding more than 230,000 jobs a month, and it did that for 8 years running. So this is a good report by our, you know, by our current standards, because we've become so accustomed to bad news, but it's not a really, really good report. But hey, we're making progress. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and it does not at the moment look like an onrushing train.
Your column today includes a reference to what you call a virtuous economic circle. What's that?
So we have a situation where basically the economy is recovering because U.S. families who came out of the bust of the housing bubble with way too much debt and basically strapped are their situation is improving. Some debt has been paid down. Some debt has been written off because of mortgage defaults and so on. But so you have a gradually improving situation of households, which is making them able to spend more, which is leading the economy to expand, which is making businesses invest more, which is making the economy expand more, which is then helping households improve their financial position further. So this is a virtuous circle. That's a recovery that, to a certain extent, is feeding on itself.
You've been arguing for 2 years that government stimulus for the economy was too small. That's in your column again today. But are these numbers an indication that maybe it was big enough?
Oh, no. I mean, think about, first of all, the fact that we're still at an unemployment rate that would have been considered inconceivable just a few years ago. We're nowhere close to, you know, there's a long way back to anything that resembles actual prosperity here. So the stimulus was, with all of that pain that we suffered for the past 2 years and the pain that we're probably going to suffer, remember, even if the unemployment rate falls, you know, below 8% by the end of this year, that'll still be really high. So all of that is a reflection of the fact that we did not do enough to rescue the economy. But time heals lots of things, and if we can wait long enough, we won't get back all of the lost person years of work that we should have been doing, but we are apparently on the mend unless we screw it up.
Though when you talk about time, the trade-off is how many trillions of dollars of accumulated long-term debt were we willing to spend for more short-term gain?
Well, that trade-off is a lot less acute than people imagine. If we had spent more on promoting recovery, first of all, we would have gotten useful things. You know, remember how many schools and bridges and other things that we have were in fact built during the 1930s by the WPA. You know, we could have been doing useful stuff. We've had a lot of workers sitting idle when they could have been producing stuff that would actually make us richer in the long run. But also, the weakness of the economy is the biggest single reason why we have budget deficits. It's not government spending. Spending, as I wrote in the column today, has actually grown less since the recession hit than it did in the years prior to the recession. So anything that would have helped the economy recover would have meant more revenue, would have meant smaller deficits. I still think that looking at this, stepping back from it, and looking at the course of the economy over the past 3 years, we would be a whole lot better off if we had another $1 trillion of debt and something that looked like full employment.
Nice ringtone, by the way. New York Times columnist.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
And Princeton economics professor Paul Krugman, my guest on WNYC. You've written several times recently about Wisconsin, obviously, including how you think Governor Scott Walker is trying to make America less of a functioning democracy and more of a third world style oligarchy, as you put it. Can they make us an oligarchy by asking state workers for a 5% or 12% contribution to their health plans and their pensions?
You know, that workers are actually willing to do a lot of that. The dispute in Wisconsin is not now about money. The unions have said that they're willing to make pretty much all the financial concessions that Walker wants. The dispute in Wisconsin is about killing the union, about denying collective bargaining rights to workers in perpetuity. So that's not it's not about money. It's not about saving the Wisconsin budget. It's about eliminating labor organizations.
Which fund the Democratic Party?
Well, which fund the Democratic Party, but not always. They sometimes, but yeah, by and large, unions are Democratic. But mostly, the point is, you know, we have a one person, one vote society. In principle, that means everybody counts equally. In practice, of course, it doesn't work that way. In practice, people who make large campaign contributions, people who can fund organized efforts, have a lot more influence than just any random voter. And in our society right now, the preponderance of those of the people and organizations in a position to exert disproportionate influence represent the wealthy. They represent corporations. Unions are one of the few counterweights to that.
People are in private sector unions anymore. Anyway, I think only about 7% of the private sector workforce. So, are there ramifications, in your opinion, for the private sector workforce, unionized or not unionized, where most people already have lost defined benefit pensions and have to settle for 401ks, ramifications from what happens in Wisconsin with collective bargaining?
Yeah, I mean, because it affects the entire political spectrum. In fact, when you have public sector unions, they exert their influence in ways that, among other things, makes it easier to organize private sector unions. So these things go hand in hand. If you and the policies that unions in general tend to advocate tend to be more pro working and middle class than the policies that that the Chamber of Commerce tends to advocate. So it's going to be a different society. If you knock away this one remaining piece of the old New Deal coalition, you're going to have a society that is one step closer to fully reproducing the old Gilded Age levels of inequality, not just of wealth, but also of political influence.
How did we get here in the private sector, by the way? What's your very short version of how we got from, I think it was more than 20% of the private workforce being unionized in the 1980s, to that 7% today?
The big change came during the Reagan years. So if you actually look at union membership numbers, you see that there's kind of a cliff that they fall off. They were in decline gradually before Reagan took office, but they really fell off a lot during the Reagan years. And the labor economists I talked to say that basically it was political, that the Reagan administration, the conservative Congress of those years, created an environment in which union busting and even more important opposition to union organizing by corporations, some of it within the law, some of it actually over the line, was tolerated. And that meant some unions were actually busted. Actually, so there was actual deunionization of some sectors. But more important, as the economy shifted, as we shifted away from the biggest companies being manufacturers to the biggest companies being in the service sector, those new companies were not unionized. So there was not. There's no law of economics that says that that Walmart could not be a unionized company, right? It's got more than a million employees. It could be the General Motors of the of the 21st century. The United big box store workers could be the equivalent of the United
right.
Auto workers.
But then they charge higher prices, which is the opposite of their business model.
Well, yeah, but you know, if all of the big boxes did the same thing, there wouldn't be the competition that they'd have to worry about. But the point is that could have happened. Had we had a different political environment in the 1980s, you could imagine that we would now be a country in which there were powerful unions in the service sector. It did not happen because the rightward turn of American politics made it possible for employers to prevent organization. And because we didn't get the organization, that rightward tilt of American politics is in part perpetuated because we don't have an effective counterweight to corporate interests.
Paul Krugman, my guest on WNYC for another few minutes. I want to ask you about one other thing. Congress, of course, is on the verge of a government shutdown over the budget, but as you know, it's over all these cuts to relatively small discretionary domestic spending
right.
items. But today, House Speaker John Boehner is quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying the House Republicans this spring will go out on a limb and propose a budget that'll tackle the real deficit problems of Social Security and Medicare, as fraught with political risk as that is. And we see the polls, even though, you know, the New York Times and everybody else says over and over again that the real long-term deficit problems are in these entitlement programs. And yet the polls show that most Americans do not want Social Security or Medicare cut. So as an economist, are you glad to see Boehner willing to go there and at least start this conversation with an actual proposal?
Well, let's see if he actually produces an actual proposal. If I looked, presumably the closest thing there is to an actual proposal is the stuff that Representative Paul Ryan has been putting out there. And Paul Ryan's stuff is one giant magic asterisk, as we say. It's just sort of savings to be explained later. We're going to replace Medicare with vouchers, and we're going to reduce the funding on those vouchers below the rate of growth of healthcare costs. And how exactly that's going to allow seniors to actually buy insurance is left unexplained. So let's put this way. There's nothing in Boehner's previous career or statements that would lead me to believe that he's going to produce an actual proposal that actually has a plausible route towards reducing future spending on those programs.
You wrote a few weeks ago that the media and politicians act as if there's a government program called Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, when really the big deficits are caused by what you listed as healthcare, and revenues. Why'd you put it that way?
Because if you want to ask, nothing works. You cannot bring the U.S. long-term budget under control without controlling healthcare costs. And if you do control those healthcare costs, then there's still a remaining gap, and the most plausible way to close that gap is by having some increase in some taxes through revenues. So it's first and foremost a healthcare problem. And then revenues can make up for the rest if you can bring that under control. And that's but you have to, the thing about healthcare costs is you can't just say let's spend less, because after all Medicare pays for actual medical treatment. So you have to say, how are we going to decide what we're not going to pay for? How are we going to find a way to achieve the same quality of medical care more cheaply?
Like the best practices review system that President Obama wanted to strengthen, and he got politically killed for it.
Yeah, although it's in the bill, right? As if we actually, the Affordable Care Act passed last year actually has quite a lot of what serious policy wonks say we need to do for healthcare cost containment. But that's right. I mean, this is, again, coming back to why I find it hard to take Boehner seriously. Having spent the last 2 years screaming death panels at any attempt to be, you know, to make sure that Medicare funds are used wisely, now he's going to come out and come up with a plausible plan to actually control Medicare costs.
Right.
hard to see how that happens.
We will see what he actually comes up with. New York Times columnist and Princeton economics professor Paul Krugman, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the currency of relationships with the interesting new Wall Street Journal columnist Catherine Rosman. Not just about money, but what else do you barter with if you're married with children or otherwise involved? The currency of relationships up next, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.